Thank you very much. I'm going to talk about scientific interpretation of scriptures. So, to begin with, let's consider the story of Lord Chaitanya in the Atmarama verse. We know that ultimately he gave some 61 different interpretations of this one verse. At the same time, he was correcting interpretations of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya that he didn't approve of. So this suggests that on the one hand, the Bhagavatam has many valid natural interpretations, and at the same time there can be incorrect interpretations also. And these interpretations are based on the background of knowledge behind the text. So, turning to the subject of science, we find that the Shastras contain many statements that have a scientific impact. For example, the reason that we oppose the theory of evolution is that the Shastra is making statements about origins which have an impact on that theory, suggesting that that theory must be in need of some correction. So, at the same time, we find that scientists and scholars tend to reject scientific statements in the Shastras as primitive or just plain wrong. This is the general viewpoint. What I would suggest here is that there are many natural interpretations of Shastras that make sense in the light of modern science, or that convey scientifically clever ideas. And these interpretations of the Shastra are of interest in presenting Krishna consciousness in the academic and scientific world. So, one pattern which I've seen empirically in looking at different examples is that these valid interpretations refer to subsets of information from the text. So in this given text, there may be two interpretations based on two different subsets of information from the text. I'll illustrate that with some examples as we go on. So I'm suggesting that a valid interpretation depends on reasonable meanings applied to significant subsets of the text. So the first example I'm going to give is taken from the chapter on calculation of time from the atom. There we find that a truti is defined as the time for the integration of 18 atoms into a molecule. And a numerical value for the truti is given. So we have 8 over 13500 seconds. So this is a very interesting statement because on the one hand, it anticipates the idea of using an atomic clock to measure time. At present, units of time are defined by atomic phenomena and then multiplied up to the larger units that we use, such as seconds and minutes and hours and so forth. So we find the same idea is there in the Bhagavatam. So this is an interesting scientific idea found in the text of the Shastra. However, the length of the truti is a bit too long. Basically, this truti comes to 1 over 1,600, roughly. So that would correspond to 1,600 kilohertz. Now, we all have our laptops here, most of which are working in the gigahertz range, or a billion computational cycles per second. So it doesn't really make sense that the combining of 18 atoms would take so long. It's 1 over 1,600 for the second. So, in fact, I give a value here for the modern truti, this rather small number, 1 over 1 followed by 12 zeros. In modern science, that would be the approximate size of the truti. So what do we do about this? It seems that on the one hand, the Shastra is giving us a very clever scientific idea. On the other hand, the value for the truti is way off. Well, I would suggest here, don't worry about the oversized truti, but give credit to the text for its interesting scientific statement about the atomic clocks. And I would suggest that we'll find some other areas where this truti comes into play. So, indeed, there is another area. I'll go through this briefly. Basically, in the story of the stealing of the calves and cowherd boys by Brahma, you learn that one shruti of Brahma is one earth year. That basic equation is given there. Now there's another story in which King Kakudmi visits Brahma Loka and then comes back. And it is said in that story that he was in Brahma Loka for 27 times 4,320,000 shrutis. Well, years, but since one earth year equals one shruti, it would be that many shrutis. Now, we find an interesting shruti mentioned in the Surya Siddhanta. It's 1/33,750, which is different from the Bhagavatam value. So, if we put these three apparently disparate elements together, you get an interesting result. Basically, you have to multiply this number, the 27 times 4,320,000, times the length of the shruti, and that will give you the number of seconds on Brahma Loka that the king was visiting there. And it comes out to 3,456 seconds if you multiply that out. And this is kind of interesting because, first of all, it means the king was there for about an hour, which makes sense in terms of the story. Because it said that he listened to a musical performance and then had a brief conversation with Lord Brahma. So an hour would be 3,600 seconds. So we have this number of seconds, which is very close to it. The other interesting thing is that the number 3, 4, 5, 6 looks rather orderly. It doesn't look like a product of chance. And I would suggest then that something is going on here. Some people, we don't know who they were making calculations involving units of time on Brahma Loka. And this is the value that they came up with. In other words, this is a product of design, not of a random chance, but to speak about Darwinian evolution. So the interesting thing to note here, by the way, is if we do this backwards, and we say, let's say the king was there for an hour, how long would the shruti be? We get something close to this value. And this shruti, by the way, is 1/20th of the Bhagavatam shruti. So it's obviously related to the Bhagavatam shruti if the ratio is 1 to 20. So it seems that we have significant use for a shruti that's about this size, or about the size of the one in the Bhagavatam. So we didn't have the despair about the shruti. We find that it's connected with something that's somewhat interesting, namely time on Brahma Loka. So let's see. Basically, I went through that summary. I'd now like to turn to a different example. And this is taken from the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam. I'm going to start with an interpretation given by one South Indian gentleman back in the 1970s. Basically, he was wondering, well, if we're on the Earth, which is a globe, which is about 8,000 miles in diameter, and the Bhagavatam is describing these huge land masses and gigantic mountains in Bhumandala, and how do we relate those two things? And he had the idea that the Earth was sort of mounted on a mountain sticking up from the base of Bhumandala. This was his proposal. And the same idea has been resurrected recently. So the first thing I will say about this is an interpretation. I would tend to think that this is perhaps not a very good interpretation because it's not based on solid scriptural evidence and it leads to many practical problems, such as if you're standing on something that is floating above these gigantic land masses, why can't you see them? You immediately have to say, well, they're invisible. So it becomes a problem. I'm going to turn to another interpretation of Bhumandala that we know of historically. And this is given in a text called the Siddhanta Shiromani, written by Bhaskaracharya in about the 11th century. So Bhaskaracharya says that most learned astronomers have stated that Jambudvipa embraces the whole northern hemisphere lying north of the South Sea, and that the other six dwipas in the seven seas are all situated in the southern hemisphere. And the ellipsis here lists all the appropriate seas and dwipas. So he's saying that Jamadvipa is the northern hemisphere of the earth. Well, in fact, this idea was going around in India. Bhaskaracharya says that most learned astronomers had this viewpoint. Here we have a globe in which we see, this globe, by the way, was commissioned by Maharaj Jai Singh of Jaipur. You see the northern hemisphere basically has all the mountain ranges and so forth of Jambudweep imprinted on it. This area here would be Varsha. And then down in the southern hemisphere, you can see the alternating oceans and dwipas. So we have historical evidence that this interpretation really was held. Here's an enlargement showing some of the features here in Varsha, for example. Here's Delhi, here's Prayag, here's Kashi, here's Gaya, that's Jagannath, and so forth. Also, we have Chin and Mahachin, that's China and Greater China. And over here, we have Mecca. So, this is an interpretation. The interesting thing about this interpretation is that here, the Earth globe is Bhumandala. It's not that it's floating next to Bhumandala. The Bhumandala is taken to be a globe. So one might raise some objections to this. Let's see. Okay, we'll go through this one first. The first objection one might raise is that, well, clearly the Bhagavatam describes Bhumandala as a flat plate. So how could it be a globe? Well, there's a scholar named Randolph Cloetzi who did a study of the cosmology in the Vishnu Purana. And he went into this in great detail and argued that the flat plate of Bhumandala as described in the Vishnu Purana corresponds to an astrolabe. An astrolabe is an instrument that was still being used in the time of Columbus and his famous voyages. Basically, in an astrolabe, you take the Earth globe and you map it onto a flat plate. We have a picture here showing how that works. If the flat plate is like this, with the pattern of Jambudweep on it, the mapping by what is called stereographic projection wraps that around the globe. Or if you start with the globe, you can unwrap it and get your map on the plate. This is nothing too mysterious. It's just a map projection. And today we have many different map projections for mapping the round globe onto a flat surface. So, according to, well, in an astrolabe, this is in fact done. The globe is mapped onto a flat plate, and the flat plate is used for computations by moving other plates with little indicators on them. So it's a kind of computational device. So, this can explain then the relationship between the Earth globe and the Bhumandala disk. There's another point where one might have some misgivings about this particular globe model, and this is that the globe is not geographically realistic. For example, in the northern hemisphere, we don't see anything like Jambudweep. Where's North America? Where's North Africa and Europe and so on and so forth? We don't see these. It's interesting that there's yet another interpretation of the text, which is backed up by quite a large amount of information, which correlates Jambudweep with a region of Asia, extending from northern India up to areas of Siberia, which are shown here. And there's a qualitative correspondence between the different mountain ranges we find in the actual globe and the different mountain changes in Jambudweep, which are shown in a somewhat more stylized fashion. So in the Vayu Purana and the Matsya Purana, there's a lot of information backing up this particular interpretation. So what we're finding here are various interpretations of Bhumandala and Jambudvipa, which serve different purposes and are based on different sets of evidence taken from the textual tradition. So, now one point that we still haven't addressed is the point that this globe that we're talking about is small in comparison with the Bhumandala disk that's described in the fifth canto. The globe is about 8,000 miles across. This is based on an analysis of the Siddhanta Shiromani or the Surya Siddhanta, the degrees of modern evidence for the size of the globe. But if you look at Bhumandala, as described in the Bhagavatam, you find that it's 4 billion miles across. So that looks like quite a discrepancy. So there I want you to resolve that. I want to turn to the Bhumandala as a large disk with the dimensions as described in the Bhagavatam. Here we have an interesting picture showing that and relating it to the orbits of the planets. This picture was made by a certain South Indian Swami who lived in the 19th century, one Tiru Venkata Ramanuja Jir Swami. Basically, I was traveling in South India and I met one Lakshmi Tatachar who runs the Sanskrit Institute in Melkot, which is a center for Ramanuja. And when he learned of my interest in the fifth canto, he brought this diagram. This is a small part of a much bigger diagram. But for the purposes of this talk, this part is of interest. Here we have the Earth globe, which interestingly enough is being shown next to Jambudvipa. Going around the Earth globe in a small orbit is the Moon. Actually, these planets can all be identified by the different figures that are shown above. These would go up to greater heights here, as you can see from the lines. Here's the Sun. Here's the axis of the Sun's chariot. Here's Mount Meru in the center. This is the same Sun at a different time, so that it's over on the other side of the figure. Here's the axis. Here's the wheel of the chariot. Here you have the Manasotra Mountain, which is like a circular racetrack that the wheel is running on. The interesting thing in this diagram, if this is the Sun, we see, of course, that the Sun is going around the Earth, which is in the center. But here are Mercury and Venus, and as you can see, they're orbiting the Sun. Here they are again over here. And as for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, they're also orbiting the Sun. They're shown with quite a bit larger orbits. Put a little ring on Saturn here, you see. So this is the diagram that Swami came up with back in the 19th century. Immediately, you can see an interesting correlation between this diagram and a diagram made by a famous Danish astronomer, Tycho Brahe, back in the 1600s. Tycho Brahe was both the most famous naked eye astronomer that we know of, and he was the last major astronomer to accept a geocentric model of the solar system. So in his model, here's the Earth, the Moon going around the Earth, here's the Sun going around the Earth, but then here's Venus and Mercury going around the Sun, and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn also going around the Sun. And everything correlates with the Swami's diagram, as you can see. So I would suggest that probably the Swami got this diagram from Tycho Brahe. After all, he lived in the 19th century, so it's perfectly plausible. But it's interesting to see what happens if you do what the Swami essentially did. If you take Bhumandala with the dimensions as given in the Bhagavatam, and you superimpose on that a geocentric model of the solar system. Well, we can do better now than Tycho Brahe. Nowadays, you can take an ephemeris program that is quite accurate, and you can translate the position of the Earth so that it remains fixed in the center, and then you'll get the orbits of the planets. You'll see, of course, that The sun is then going around the Earth, and the various planets are going around the sun. We're getting the 5-minute limit here. I'm going to skip a little bit about
it again,
just so that we can have time to talk about it. Okay. This is an illustration of what I just described in using Mercury as an example. The blue spirograph-like line is the geocentric orbit of Mercury. Basically, you have the Sun going around the Earth and Mercury going around the Sun, so naturally you're going to get a spiral pattern like this. And that's what you see in blue here. The interesting thing that you note with this pattern, and I guess I'll pause here momentarily and give a little bit of the history behind this, because I found the Swami's diagram later. But the way this thing originally came up was that Hari Kesh wanted an arrangement showing the planets above Blue Mandala, or the temple of the Vedic planetarium. And he said, well, so show the planets over Blue Mandala. And I said, well, I don't think that's going to work. But he kept repeating it on various occasions. So finally one day I thought, okay, I'll do it, I'll see what happens. I didn't expect to get any results. But what I found when I did it was, as we can see here in the case of Mercury, this envelope curve of the spiral geocentric orbit is tangent to one of the ring structures of Blue Mandala. And the inner boundary curve is also tangent to one of the ring structures of Blue Mandala. Now the same is true of the other planets, and there are quite a number of other details which all fit together to indicate that Blue Mandala is acting in effect as a map of the geocentric orbits of the planets. By the way, if you run your computer long enough, the spirograph pattern will fill into a solid donut shape, which is tangent to the outer curve at one point and to the inner curve at another point. So this is an interpretation that emerges with regard to the size of the features of Blue Mandala. So we go from the small Earth globe now to the full-sized Blue Mandala, and we find that those magnitudes do have a value, even though one has to leave them aside when looking just at the small Earth globe. Another interesting correlation emerged from this. A scientific study of the Yojana showed that, a historical study based on Megasthenes, the Seleucid Greek ambassador to India, and some of the Chinese Buddhist pilgrims. It indicated that there are basically two yojanas, one of which is about half the size of the other. It actually comes out to 16/30 of the other yojana. Well, if you go back to the orbit diagram, you can see that depending on how big the yojana is, this orbit, or equivalently the Blue Mandala map, will shrink or expand. And so the question is, what is the best value for the yojana? Using a root mean square test here, I found that the best value for the yojana comes to 8.5 miles. And it is interesting, further historical study revealed information indicating that the ancient Egyptians had a value for their units, which we can then relate to the yojana. Basically, they were basing units on divisions of a degree of latitude. It turns out that the 8.5 mile yojana corresponds to 7.5 minutes of latitude as measured at the equator. The other shorter yojana corresponds to exactly 4 degrees, minutes of latitude. 1/4 of that is a unit called prosha, which is 1 minute of latitude, and that is the same as the nautical mile, which is being used to this very day. So the whole point is that by taking a certain degree of flexibility and looking at different interpretations, and basing these interpretations on good evidence, you can find a lot of interesting things in the Shastra. And I think that this may be of interest also to people in the academic world. Of course, it's going to take a lot of introduction in order to do this. I've had a somewhat spotty publication experience in the academic world, but I did see some interesting conniption fits when I presented some of these ideas. But, okay, we are at zero time, and I only had to drop about three slides.
Thank you very much, Swami Kutumbu. So we can open it up for questions. Any questions or comments?
Yeah.
Can you share what the nature of these conniption fits were?
Well, sure. They're sort of live in action.
Do you have a slide of one of those fits?
I'll briefly describe that story. There was another one of these interesting correlations, which involved a verse in the Surya Siddhanta, which lists the diameters of the planets projected to the orbit of the moon. So I looked at that verse and I thought, well, if these are the diameters of the planets that are projected to the orbit of the moon, what if I project backwards to the real distances of the planets? Then I should find their actual diameters. It's another one of these lost hope type calculations. Well, I did that, and I found an interesting result. For three of the planets, I got the actual diameter of the planet within 10%. And I couldn't expect better than 10% given the number of decimal places given in the verse, which wasn't very much. And for two of the planets, I got the radius, that was half the diameter, given the 10% accuracy. And so I asked myself, well, okay, how likely is it that doing a calculation like this, based on ancient data, that I should get a mixture of diameters and radii? So I went back to the actual method that they used to use to measure diameters of planets with the naked eye, looking through the pinholes and so forth. And I found that it's exceedingly improbable that you'd hit the correct diameters or radii using naked eye astronomy. So I wrote this up in a paper and presented it to a person at Harvard whose name I better not drop, just to be politically correct. So this person had a true conniption fit. She became utterly hysterical.
What department was she in?
Well, she's a student of David Pingree.
Oof.
Well, he's a very respected academician.
He passed away.
Probably so. He was very elderly when I met him.
Yeah, he passed away about a few months ago.
Yeah, I met him. I met his dogs also.
They probably knew what you were up to.
So I decided that I would go to more favorable people. So I went to the Society for Scientific Exploration. These are the people that support and publish Ian Stevenson works and the works of the Princeton parapsychologists and so forth. So I actually got the planetary diameter paper published in their journal. So I thought, well, I'm doing pretty well. So I wrote up this orbit correlation study and sent that into these people, and it was rejected out of hand. And the reason given was that the Bhagavatam is a religious scripture. And that was sufficient. I mean, you just don't find science in a religious scripture. It's not done. So there's a certain amount of inertia and prejudice to be met there. But gradually, it could be overcome. Yeah?
Going back to the Truti measurements.
Yeah.
Is it possible that the difference could be explained by measuring instruments that were coarser?
Well, the statement is a theoretical statement.
Okay.
And the statement is that 18 atoms, well, it goes by, first you form hexatoms, groups of six, and then you combine three of those together to form an 18-atom unit. But that takes that amount of time. So that's a theoretical statement.
Not based on measurement.
You could postulate that it's based on measurements. If so, their atomic physics is a bit different from ours. See, if you go down that route, you wind up with a rather difficult position to defend. You could say, well, maybe in those days, atoms combined more slowly.
but if you had a measuring instrument that was capable of measuring certain fractions of seconds, but not extremely small fractions.
Yeah, could be. I mean, that's a possibility. Yeah?
First, you helped me a lot here. One thing is, my wife always says I'm late and I'm going to claim different truthies now. So you give me some justification.
Well, if you take truthies of Lord Brahma, then
it's different. Measurements of that. So I have a Shastri basis. But the question is, there's incredible information coming out from text that is obviously older than, I don't care what age you give the Bhagavatam, any age you want to give it, the youngest age you can give it, we're dealing with information that was clearly not available in the scientific world until well after it was written. So then the question is, how did the folks know it? Well, they knew it by revelation. How come they didn't get it exactly right? They knew it by the words. How is this known?
Well, there are those two basic possibilities.
Yeah.
Either you have to postulate an ancient civilization older than the civilizations we know, in which people have this kind of scientific knowledge, and that somehow in a sort of imperfect way, pieces of it came down to our own time. And then the other alternative is that some sage or yogi with connection with higher beings acquired the knowledge. That would be an idea that you find in India itself, because, for example, in the Surya Siddhanta, it is said that the text was communicated to Mayasura by an emissary of the Sun Ra. So the idea of getting it from higher sources is there in Indian tradition. I tend to prefer, actually, the idea of the ancient civilization because of all these correlations with ancient metrology in Egypt. There are also correlations, well, if you look into it, they go all over the world. And this would seem to suggest that people in the ancient past had a more advanced science, and that there was a period of darkness, the Dark Ages, and then people recovered from that to some extent in classical antiquity, then went into another Dark Ages, and then began to recover in the Renaissance, and then that brings us to the present day. Yeah?
Regarding the truthies, this correspondence that you make between, well, the Surya Siddhanta, the version of the truthies, and the story of King Kakuni and the difference in time between our time and Brahma's time, what you get from that, it seems to me, is you get a coherence between the Surya Siddhanta version of the Truthi and a story from Bhagavata. And what I'm not clear about is, is that supposed to help us figure out some way of understanding some correspondence between either the Surya Siddhanta or the Bhagavata's definition of a truthi and the modern, calculation as to how long that would take? And also, what do you made this point about there being this even ratio of 1 to 20, right, between the Surya Siddhanta and the Bhagavata.
Yes.
And I wonder what you make of that ratio.
Well, the basic way that I look at it is as follows. First of all, the as you said, you're seeing a coherence between the Cowherd Boy story, the King Kikudmi story,
yeah,
and the treaty in the Sirius event. They all mesh together. And the fact that the number is 3, 4, 5, 6 suggests that this was done deliberately by somebody. So, what does that have to do with the modern treaty, 1/10 to the 12th power? And I would suggest that just as in the astronomical examples, we saw first, we had a Bhoomandala model which ignored the very large distances in Bhoomandala. And then later we came to an interpretation that took into account those large distances. What I'm saying is a similar thing in the case of the treaty, that in the case of the Bhagavatam, that's one where we ignore the large treaty that they're using. But that large treaty comes into play in connection with the Suryasiddhanta and the two stories. Now there's one further point there, namely the ratio of 20, because the treaty in the Bhagavatam is not exactly the same as the treaty in the Suryasiddhanta.
It sounds like it's not exactly, but it's in the same ballpark, by a measure of 20.
It's off by a measure of 20. Yes, if you directly use the Bhagavatam treaty in the King Kikudmi calculation, then you'd find that the king was there for about 20 hours, which wouldn't be so good from the point of view of the story, and also that would obscure the 3, 4, 5, 6 number, so the whole thing would become much weaker.
It depends on what the concept is.
Can I ask a question for Sariputta?
Sure.
It's a question I've been asking myself, and I'll talk about it in my talk 2 days. But I just wanted your feedback. You spent a lot of time trying to look at the Bhagavatam in a scientific way and show how it has scientific relevance. But what's the point of doing that? I mean, why bother doing that? Why do you do that?
Why do I do that?
Yeah, that's my question.
Ultimately, it has to do with facilitating people's faith. Because for some reason, the Bhagavatam was written with reference to things that impinge on science, as you saw in that one slide that I had there. Things that have scientific statements that would have an impact on one's scientific view of the world. So because those statements are there, you have to deal with them. For example, I mentioned the point that the Vedic literature tends to go against the theory of evolution as it's generally understood by scientists. So, okay, here you are. You're trained up believing in evolution from an early age. I mean, for me, it started with the world we live in, with the pictures of the dinosaurs and so forth. I think I first got that when I was about 7.
Oh, dear.
So, this is early indoctrination.
I'm telling you. Poor guy.
But anyway, so, just to continue on this example, so, you come into contact with Krishna consciousness with a thoroughgoing belief in evolution. I remember being in Hari Nam parties in Manhattan. We were there with the Mrdungas and everything, and I was thinking, well, what about the dinosaurs? Ultimately, there needs to be an answer to these questions that will satisfy people. And there's the basic consideration that if the text is saying things that are wacko as far as science is concerned, then how can you put faith in the transcendental statements which are beyond your present level of realization? Because many of us do not have any direct realization of these higher levels of bhakti. If we did, we could probably say, you know, to heck with science and all those different issues. Simply sit on under a tree like the Goswamis and drink the nectar of Krishna consciousness and influence people through our purity and our effulgence and so forth. But there are problems with faith. I remember when the fifth canto first came out, I was in Atlanta at the time, and I was taking a walk through the nearby golf course that's up over the hill there.
Candler.
And looking at the trees. And I knew from the fifth canto there's a description of trees that are as large as the diameter of the earth. And I was looking at the trees there on the golf course and thinking, well, these trees aren't that big. There's nothing I can do to force that. So how am I going to understand this? So ultimately, you need to have some understanding. So that would be the basic motivation, why science is important. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur during his time, there were many people who were claiming that this is all mythology. So then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, why not you consider, even if it is mythology, the philosophy being presented is something powerful. So could it be possible that the science in the Bhagavatam is all, you know, just written by some human, maybe it's been added to the original scripture, or things have been changed while it was being passed down, you know, like the Mahabharata. We have so many things in the Mahabharata that are rejected by Madhvacharya. He says, you know, that's a later addition. Is that possible in the Bhagavad?
Well, the problem I would see with that approach, and of course that may be true, you know, you consider, well, perhaps the Bhagavatam is corrupt. But why, if so, is it only corrupt in the sections dealing with material phenomena and not the transcendental parts? Yeah?
This is an interesting question for us because aside from textual corruption and things like that, you know, for a long time Christians have said, we did demythologize it, and you know, the part about the spiritual realm or the spiritual activities about God and Jesus or whatever, that's okay, and the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. But you know, when we come to the view of the world that's really old-fashioned, we can demythologize, we can dump all that, and keep, you know, the same career of Jesus and all this other stuff. But you know, in the Christian ontology, you know, God and the world are like pretty separate. There's no ocean of milk. Okay, so the ocean of milk is a thing. Well, then what about kurma? once you start with our picture, once you start doing like this, and things are very interweaving, and you pick the, you know, the mundane thread we're going to pull out, you tend to like unweave the whole cloth. I just think this is a special problem with us because everywhere you start looking, the Krishna's activities in the world are much more, and the world are much more interwoven than they are in the Abrahamic faiths. Mm. You know, the world is secular and God is divine. They tend to be like that. We're a little different.